This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.
Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest chapter of Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, the erotic writer extraordinaire, as she will always be known to us, her flock and her followers, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Leslie Ann, a very good day to you.
Good day to you, Mr. Michael Sir. And how's it hanging?
Well, it's hanging really well, and I'm getting quite excited now because I am reading in an esteemed publication, as I speak to you, that tomorrow, Saturday, this weekend, Boris Johnson may even make it later today, apparently. Boris Johnson is poised to signal later today or tomorrow, that Britain is on track to lift all final lockdown restrictions on June the 21st. As ministers step up discussions on the return to ordering drinks at the bar. That is the vital and crucial phrase that I've been waiting to hear for over 12 months, Leslie Ann. Drinks at the bar.
So will we still have to book to go into a pub to have drinks at the bar?
No.
We can just wander in off the street.
This is the whole point. I mean, look, I don't know about you, but at the moment you can wander in off the street, providing they've got some vacant tables, okay? But as you've quite rightly said, certainly when it was just gardens, you couldn't get in anywhere because there were so few tables around. You know, they were just basically using it as a training exercise to get their pub back up and running again. But certainly over the last few days, I've been to pubs I've been using for years, some in town, not far from Fleet Street, actually, some locally down here in Stockbroker Belt. And it's still an absolute pain in the butt to have to stand at the door. You're not allowed in unless you've got a face mask on. And then have we got a table for you? You can have that one over there for 2 hours. And then your drinks have to be brought to you. I mean, look, I'm very, very grateful the pubs are back open. But that's not the pub as we know it. And it's not the pub in the sense that you and I want to wander up and down Fleet Street, in and out, you know, of the Bell, in and out of the Cheshire Cheese, in and out of, what's the great wine bar called? Sorry, my head's gone.
That used to be the Wine Press, but it's not there anymore. Perhaps you mean Elvino.
Elvino's, that's exactly what I mean. There's two Elvino's, by the way. There's one round by Blackfriars Station, round the bottom of Fleet Street, and then there's
not
one
as good as the old one, is it?
It's not. No, the old one is the one, but that hasn't been open for so long now. So, you know, that's what I'm really looking for. People think I'm mad to keep going on about pubs, but they'd understand that I'm not, you know, an alcoholic, and I'm not, you know, desperate to be able to get into a pub to have a drink every day. I love the pub industry. I love the institution of pubs. And I'm very aware of the huge contribution they make to the economy. And what I see is, if I see a thriving pub industry, I see a thriving UK economy. And hopefully you and I are going to test that out now, Ms. Jones, after June the 21st, which is only, it's out of my head, it's only like 3 weeks away.
Yeah, I think the thing about it is it's a very specific, unique part of culture, isn't it?
It is.
The pub. I think we say things to each other across a bar,
yes,
or side by side at the bar that we wouldn't perhaps say out there in normal life under all the pressures and so on. Yeah. Some of the best interviews I ever did were standing at the bar in a pub or a wine bar or somewhere.
Yes.
Because people open up. And they relax in a way that they can't do in the outside world. Mm-hmm. And I just think it's a get-out clause, isn't it? It's a very good thing to be able to do. Just if I, as we used to in the old days when we all worked there, go out on Fleet Street, bump into somebody, oh, have you got time for a quick half? You know,
absolutely.
Which was a euphemism for a bottle of wine or five gin and tonics or whatever.
That's right.
And as you say, it's not that we were all alcoholics.
Yeah.
It was just there was a very special pause in the day when you could go into a place with somebody you were like-minded with and chew the cud and get things off your chest.
It was the meeting place, wasn't it? It was a hostelry. It was where, you know, that's where coffee houses originated, wasn't it? You know, and that's where, you know, the London Stock Exchange originated. It's a huge part of our cultural history. And people,
it's almost
sometimes,
therapy, actually.
It's therapy. I agree. And, you know, I've said this before on this very podcast, you know, I'm a bit of a loner sometimes because I want to ingest information, read some papers or some journals or magazines. I like to get into the back of a pub, you know, outside of normal view and just indulge myself in a few pints of beer and ingesting information. We all love information as journalists, don't we? Because we want to know about things.
Yeah, we do. And it's not the same doing that at home by yourself.
You know,
you can pour a drink or you can have a cup of tea or whatever, but it's just not the same. It's part of being part of the action, part of what's going on.
Do you know,
especially those old pubs on Fleet Street
during
Fleet Street's heyday.
Yeah. Do you know, it's funny you should say that, but the layout of my penthouse is that I have a lounge, and off the lounge I have a kitchen, and off the kitchen I have the door out into the roof garden. And in the roof garden, I've got cover and all that. And do you know what? Although the weather's been shocking ever since last November, I am now having work done on the place to make it almost like a pub at home. So I've got a table in the kitchen, which is the same height as a table you find in a bar with a high stool. You see what I mean? And I can sit at that table and I can drink a pint of beer and I can look at my television in one direction, look at the entrance to my garden in the direction, go out in the garden, sit under a parasol and enjoy a glass of wine. I have actually turned it into a sort of home pub, you know, just to try and make myself feel at home, so to speak.
So you'll be dressing your housekeeper up as a barman yet?
I wouldn't think so. I mean, she's a lady of a certain age and, you know, people might look at me a bit funny if she started turning up here looking like somebody was just here to serve the drinks. An esteemed lady, and she's been with me for years and does a very good job. Just another tangent on that one, Leslie Ann. Pub chain resists calls for wage rise after reopening triggers scramble, to hire staff. Every pub I've been into since partial lockdown has been unlocked, i.e., you know, you can go and sit in at tables in pubs, every pub I've been into has had a sign saying, you know, help wanted, vacancies available and all that. All those young kids who were here when we were in Europe before Brexit have all gone home.
Yeah, well, I mean, my son is working in a pub at the moment. He's an assistant manager in a pub in London. You know, the theatre industry is locked down, so you've got to work for your living. You've got to pay your rent.
Of course,
so he's working in this pub. He is absolutely worn out. He's rushed off his feet. He's also doing singing gigs in the pub every other week with his friend Billy on the keyboards, and they do a sort of sing for your supper type night. People book in and they can have dinner, three-course meal, and get the entertainment as well. So he's burning the candle at all ends, playing cricket every Sunday, and he's absolutely
very
wiped
good.
Out.
Very good. Well, that's what
the
young
pub has never
do.
Been busier. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they've got plenty of energy. One of the pubs I use down in Surrey is called The Harrow. And their barmaids, and I'm not being sexist, they were all girls, all ladies, females, exclusively came from Eastern Europe, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland. And you've never met a more helpful, hardworking, diligent and dedicated staff. I'm not joking. They just wanted to get everything right. You know, they were constantly wiping your table. They were, you know, making sure your order was right. How's your food, Mr. Parry? You know, and would you like another drink? Shall I bring onto your table? Terrific like that, you know. And I'm not saying that English people aren't as good as that, but when those people came from what was formerly Eastern Europe, which was a closed society, and found the freedom to work in a free economy like ours, and the rewards that it brought to them working in the capitalist world, they started to appreciate it an awful lot more than youngsters who've grown up in this country.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I wonder how things will pan out now that we don't have those people here anymore.
I don't know, but I hope they come back because, you know, there's room for everybody in this country.
Are they going to be allowed to come back?
Well, this is what the government have got to sort out. I've never had a problem with immigration. You've got to have immigration into a country for two reasons. Firstly, if the economy's growing, you need more workers. But secondly, we can't provide all the expert skills that are needed in this country. So, of course, we've got to import doctors and engineers and scientists. I mean, that's the way the world works, isn't it? You can't just be insular about it.
No, you can't. But if we are not allowed to go and live and work in other countries, surely it works both ways.
Well, I think the world's got to come to some kind of an agreement with that. You know, the free movement of labour is a free world. The only place that, you know, doesn't let people out and let people in are places like North Korea. And nobody wants to live in North Korea. Now then, Ms. Jones, of course, you are part of the showbiz entertainment industry and have been for years. How do you think GMB, Good Morning Britain, are getting on with their attempts to fill the gap left by our old pal Piers Morgan deciding to leave? Have you been keeping an eye on it? And if so, what do you think?
I don't really watch it, as you know. I'm rushing around too much in the mornings to have breakfast telly on. I tend to be a radio person. But
I don't blame you. I mean, I was on the radio for 20 years and still am. So I can imagine why you would find my voice, you know, rather more appealing than the ugly face of Piers Morgan.
I wouldn't call Piers Morgan ugly.
Well, but, he's not ugly, but he's starting to show a bit of middle-aged flab, isn't he?
Sorry, Piers, I'm joking. Even when somebody's on the television and you don't watch that show, when they are so famous for doing it, you are aware of their presence in a weird way, even when you don't sit down and watch it. Does that make sense?
Yes, totally.
So I feel the loss of Piers on that show and I don't actually watch it.
Yeah, no, I totally agree.
I hope that doesn't make me sound like a weirdo. But I sort of feel that he needs to...
Don't worry. We already know about your weirdo side of your life, Miss Jones. Don't worry about that.
Thank you very much. I think that Piers needs to go back to GMTV. And I hope he does. But I think in the meantime, the fact that Bill Turnbull has stepped up to the plate, even though he's pretty ill, he has prostate cancer, I would take issue with the fact that people keep describing his condition as fighting terminal prostate cancer. Do we really fight cancer?
Do you know what? I so totally agree with you on that. When I remember the brave battle against... No, you've got no option. You've got to try and stop it happening. It's not a brave battle. You've got no alternative, have you?
No, it's not a fight. It's not a battle. It's... all you're doing is doing everything you can to stay alive. But you're not fighting a disease. It's impossible to fight a disease. So I don't know why they always wrote that. It's one of the things that really irritates me, but there you go. Yeah. Great that Bill Turnbull's doing it. I do wish Piers would come back. I'd probably start watching it if he did. Yeah. I think he's probably missing his profile.
Yes. I don't think he will come back now. I think like a lot of programmes and a lot of TV stations these days, the GMB people have gone a bit woke. And I think they've looked at it and thought, well, you know, is it such a bad thing for Piers to go? I think it's a terrible thing. I think their figures will suffer. But it was very odd that they had Alistair Campbell on to take up the Piers slot for 3 days a couple of weeks ago. I mean, Alistair is a man with a huge reputation. Not all of it is for good things. And Piers, funnily enough, wrote in his column, which he writes in the Mail on Sunday every week, that he left because he decided he didn't want to apologise, as his bosses wanted him to, for not believing things said by, and he described her as Princess Pinocchio, obviously Meghan Markle, okay? But then he added a real barb at the end. He said, I find it surprising that the person who is now sitting in my seat for the next 3 days of the week has never apologised for getting involved in an illegal war in which 1 million people died. That was quite cutting, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, he's got a point. But they never have seen eye to eye, have they, Piers and Alistair?
No, never. But it's very interesting, you know, when people look at it and the balances and all that. And what you say about Bill is absolutely right. I saw him this week. He was on earlier this week. And I have to say, he looked very well. And, you know, he's working with Susanna and they worked together at the BBC on the Breakfast Show, didn't they, a few years ago?
But
if Bill is, quotes, you know, bravely fighting, as we've just discussed, and I wish him the very, very best of luck, by the way, he certainly looks good on it. He's got some new kind of treatment, you know, where they put like a miniature submarine in his blood system. It's amazing. And it's full of something like plutonium or something. It makes him radioactive as it goes around his system. He's not allowed to hug his grandchildren and all that kind of stuff. Goodness. But it gets right into the, you know, the center of your system, because as we all know, radiation is used to fight cancer.
Yeah. I know a few people, three specifically, who are living with prostate cancer.
Right.
And they are living with it as opposed to fighting it, as opposed to thinking that they're terminally ill.
Yeah.
Because quite honestly, we're all terminally ill. We're all going to die. Yeah. So, you know, it's just a question of degrees, isn't it? When and how and how long we've got left and so on.
Yeah.
But I think that is probably key to survival. Not necessarily recovery, but survival is to make the choice to live rather than to be living on borrowed time.
Oh, no, I totally agree. The doctors have said to me, you know, I was given 36 hours to live at the height of my heart problems when I was flown back from Portugal with acute heart failure. I couldn't breathe. I mean, you know, it was hopeless. And unless something had changed in those 36 hours, I'd had it. And it was only through the, you know, the huge efforts of the doctors, and they pumped about 9 litres of water out of my body to allow my lungs to work again and all that kind of stuff. But then, you know, I was in hospital for 7 months waiting for a heart transplant. I've told this story many times. I'm not looking for medals or anything. But what I'm saying is I had a huge determination in my head to try and get better because I didn't like being in hospital and I wanted to be up on my feet and getting about and getting on with my job and not letting my career slip away. And it was a determination. And so there is definitely a mind over matter factor.
Yeah, I think, yeah, for all of us, we can choose to be a victim or we can choose to rise above.
Yes.
And I think Bill Turnbull is one of those fine examples of somebody who chooses just to get on with it.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Anyway, we don't just discuss gloomy matters, of course, on Life on Planet Porky. We like to be uplifting. And talking about peers, Piers is married to a beautiful lady and a very talented journalist called Celia Walden. I wonder if you know her or have met her, Leslie-Anne, because what I didn't understand until I read a piece about Piers and, you know, whatever he's doing these days, that Celia Walden was actually a lingerie model when Piers met her.
No, she was a journalist.
That's what I thought, but she worked for a company called Victoria's Secrets as well.
No, I don't think that's true.
I
actually don't think that's true. She was a journalist. She went to interview Piers. That's how they met.
Right. Okay. Well, there's another version.
Maybe
of that story.
She did a piece. I think maybe she did a piece on Victoria's Secret.
Well, maybe modelled some of the stuff herself because she's so good.
Maybe she did. Yeah, because she's a very good-looking girl. Maybe that's what happened. But she was definitely a journalist.
Right. Okay. Well, I accept that because I read her column when it. She writes in the Telegraph, funny enough. And I read a column all the time, and she is very good. Ms. Jones, what is your view on UFOs, right? Because all our lives, we've all been obsessed by UFOs. And yet, I just mentioned the Daily Telegraph. A paper as esteemed as the Daily Telegraph has written recently, you know, a very sort of informative piece that the government are once again now starting to take seriously reports of UFO. And some of the evidence they've got now comes from American fighter pilots, including one who was a female US fighter pilot who has, you know, written an affidavit which says absolutely she saw what is now called the Tic Tac. That's a form of little sweet, isn't it? Like a little mint or something like that. But there have been half a dozen now independent reports from US fighter pilots, the highest trained pilots in the world, have spotted this sort of machine, and there's no explanation for what it is. So what do you think?
Well, I think that now that more and more credible witnesses are coming forward, this one Navy pilot who has said that technologically these craft are 1,000 years in advance of our own.
They go across speed at 3 times the speed of sound in a second, don't they?
Yes, there was one, this particular one, who said he saw craft every single day for a couple of years.
Yeah.
And Obama, former President Obama, has talked about having seen the files early on into his presidency. And there was, to begin with, the US government had a very grudging acceptance of these sightings. But I think now, with world order feeling so disrupted, all the extreme weather conditions we're going through, the many volcanic eruptions, viral pandemics, who's to say that these things aren't linked and that something isn't happening in deeper outer space that could be the answer to all our questions at the moment?
Yeah, but why has their presence never been made on Earth on terra firma. If they're that advanced, why not just land?
I think maybe they have. Maybe there have been landings.
What, Men in Black are you talking about?
No, I'm not talking about Men in Black. I didn't describe anything, did I? I just said maybe there have been landings that have been covered up, because lots of these things have been classified by governments around the world. And maybe there is a whole international dossier of these kinds of things happening that we haven't been told about, because it would freak us all out.
Yeah, it may be. There's a very famous report of a police officer in, I think it's Suffolk, or it was kind of Norfolk-Suffolk border.
Yeah. Didn't they dispel that as a myth?
Well, I'm not sure, because he's driving a patrol car one night, very bright lights in the sky, and then a very bright light on the road. And the guy's had, you know, he had to be retired from the police force because he had psychotic lapses and couldn't get over it. So,
well, maybe that's what they said. They explained having to sort of pension him off or something because they didn't want to accept what he was saying.
Well, honestly, the problem is, until we actually see one, get a picture of one, talk to one, communicate with one, I will not believe they exist. I think it's all myth. And it's all very well, you know, you can say, how can you dismiss the observations of, you know, highly trained US Air Force fighter pilots? I'd say it's phenomena. It's like the Bermuda Triangle. You know, it's natural occurrences which either form shapes or something. But look, as none of us know, how can you tell? We talked about Noel Gallagher in our last podcast, Miss Jones, and it was about him and Ringo Starr. I've always got an eye out for reading stuff about Noel Gallagher and Liam Gallagher. Can you believe that he made a comment recently saying he prefers one of his sons over the other?
So I'll
read this piece to you. He risks shattering their domestic bliss, the domestic bliss of himself and his wife, Sarah, 49, by admitting he has a favourite out of
bed. How old is he, by the way? Why are we saying her age and not his?
I don't know. It's just the piece I'm reading. Noel is 53, by the way, just to let you know. I've just picked that up as well.
Okay.
He risks shattering their domestic bliss by admitting he has a favourite out of their sons, Donovan, 13, and Sonny, 10. Noel, 53, said of Sonny on a podcast, "He's my favourite at the minute. I'm having a good laugh with him at the moment." What would you feel? And you are a mother of three anyway, and you have been married and had a husband, obviously. What would you feel if your husband suddenly nominated one of your children as his favourite over another?
Well, it sounds as though Noel is making a joke of it. And we have a joke in our family as well. I always say to Mia, "You're my favourite firstborn." I say to Henry, "You're my favourite son," because I've only got one. And I say to Bridie, "You're my favourite youngest child."
Right.
So, you know, we make a bit of a joke of it in that way.
Yeah.
I think he's having a laugh here. He's at the moment, he's telling Sonny he's the favourite child. But, you know, I'm sure he tells the other one as well. I wouldn't take this too seriously. Anyone who genuinely does that, tells their kids one over the other, "You're the favorite, you're the one that I love, woo hoo hoo," I think that's a very stupid thing to do, because that can leave children with lasting psychological damage, which you're going to have to pay for the therapist further down the line.
I totally agree. It's funny to say that, but I call my niece, and I've only got one niece, niecey number one, you know what I mean?
Same sort of thing, isn't it?
And I've got two sisters, so whenever you send them a birthday card, I always write inside "to the best joint sister in the world," you know what I mean? Because if you put "the best sister in the world" and the other one goes round to the house and sees it, they'd wonder if I favour that sister over the other one, you know what I mean? So I totally agree. It's a family thing, and he probably means nothing of it. But so I think parents do have favourites. I mean, I'm convinced that my younger sister, that's Jill, right, who was a lovely little child because she had sort of bubbly ginger hair. She and I were ginger. My other sister, Adrienne...
You were a ginger? I didn't know you were a ginger.
Oh, yeah, yeah. A bright ginger hair. My hair was so...
You had dark hair when you were on Fleet
Street. No. When I was a kid, my hair was so ginger that I was called Ginger Nut at school. In fact, one rather cruel schoolmate said, "I'm going to call you Jaffa Cake." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Because you're ginger on top, but soft underneath," which I thought was rather cruel.
How did he know?
Yeah, well, no, he meant about my brain. You know what I mean?
Oh, I see. Right,
yeah,
right.
You know, ginger on top, soft brain.
I thought we had a bit of scandal going on.
No, scandal going on, for goodness sake.
I never knew you had ginger hair because you were you were dark on Fleet Street.
Well, I was kind of auburn on Fleet Street, but that did move from ginger on top.
What, did you dye your hair then?
No, it just naturally developed from bright ginger to sort of auburn and then sort of brownish and then what it is now, silver fox, you know, which is a very distinguished look.
Very distinguished, absolutely.
Yeah. But Jill, my little sister, A, she was the youngest. B, she wasn't as outgoing, as confident as myself and my elder sister, you know, because we, I don't know, perhaps we'd been around longer. But my mum definitely favoured her and I didn't mind that. Because I was very protective of my little sister in those days, and still am, actually. I still regard her as my little sister. So I don't mind, really, if parents have a favourite, to be honest. I think, you know, a close thing between a parent and a child isn't a bad thing.
So I knew that my mum didn't favour me when I was a child. I was the eldest of four, still am.
Right.
18 months between myself and my brother. And I knew that my mum favoured my brother. And then there was a big gap.
Yeah.
And then she had two more very close together. So obviously, the more children a family has, the more the elder child gets pushed out.
Yes.
Because the mum has to focus on the younger children.
Yes.
And so I did sort of feel out on a limb as a kid. I did feel that my mum didn't love me. And yeah. I remember saying to her once, ridiculously, I was adopted, wasn't I? You don't love me the same as you love the other kids. I must have had a real chip on my shoulder about that.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, that's a harrowing story. I think sometimes parents will say, well, you're older, you know, you've been around longer, you can look after yourself, I'll look after the little one or something like that. But
yeah, exactly.
You know,
exactly.
And maybe that's the way it works. But I'm sure all our parents love us enormously. Right, OK, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Just to get into a bit of rock and roll here, Leslie Ann, somebody's trying to make a biopic on the Sex Pistols, but as ever, as usual, we've talked about this with other groups, but not the Sex Pistols, it's all going to end up ashes in the mouth because they can't agree on the money again.
Well, I don't think it's even that. It's the fact that Danny Boyle is making this series. It's a six-part drama called Pistol for Disney's FX channel.
Right.
And it's based on the memoir of the guitarist Steve Jones.
Right.
But John Lydon, who we know and love as Johnny Rotten,
yeah,
has come out and alleged that the actor who's playing him, a guy called Anson Boom, was selected to play him without any participation or consent on his part. Mm-hmm. And he's saying, this guy can't play me unless I say he can. Well, hello, yes, they can.
Yeah.
Did Claire Foy or Olivia Colman need the Queen's consent to play Her Majesty in The Crown?
Sure.
You see? So you absolutely can play a real-life character in a film or a TV series without the subject's consent, if that person is still alive.
Yeah.
He's saying things like, if I'm put in a corner like a rat, I'm going to go for your throat. And he's going to bring this to court and a huge legal battle will ensue. He will lose because you can say anything about anybody in print or on screen or on the radio or any kind of broadcast as long as it's true.
Yeah.
So, you know, there will be dramatic interpretation. I remember hearing that Mary Austin, who was Freddie Mercury's girlfriend for many, many years, and then sort of his companion, she worked for him and so on, she decided that she didn't want to be portrayed in their film, Queen's film, Bohemian Rhapsody. And she brought a legal case against Queen Productions and the film company, which was GK Films, to prevent them from portraying her. She lost. And an actress did portray her in that film because there is no law against it. So I think Johnny Rotten, John Lydon, is going to come unstuck here.
Yeah. No, I'm sure he will. And you hate these rows, don't you? You wish he'll get together. You know, once again, we can't go through a podcast without mentioning John Lennon. My favourite piece of John Lennon footage of all time is an interview he gave to somebody in New York. I don't think it was Andy Peebles, who you know very well, but it's when he talked about the possibility of the Beatles getting back together, and he was so laid back about it. He said, look, who knows? One of these days, the four of us might all walk into a room. If we're not doing anything else, if we feel like doing it, it could happen. Why would I ever worry about Paul? But I worried about Ringo. I wanted Rick to make sure Ringo was all right. And he was in such a good mood and so warm. And I'm convinced from that it probably would have happened if two of them hadn't died.
Yeah, it's tragic, isn't it? And, you know, a lost opportunity. It is a shame. But when you think what they went through, and they had such a concentrated career over the space of only 7 years.
Absolutely.
And they were a global phenomenon.
Yeah.
And they also grew up during that time, and they became different people.
Oh,
it's
so totally
no
agree.
Surprise to me that that band broke down,
so
and
totally
that they
agree.
All went off to explore themselves and their careers in other directions. But yeah, a reunion would have been lovely, but it wasn't to be.
How do you handle the fact that one minute you're playing basically the Cavern in Liverpool, and 3 years later you are one of the most famous people in the world and one of the most successful rock stars of all time? That happened in 3 years. That happened between 61 and 64, or 62 and 65.
Yeah, and you're only in your early 20s, you know.
Yeah,
something has to
exactly.
give, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly, in your early 20s. People forget that, bloody hell, when Sgt. Pepper's came out, you know, still, in my view, the most successful album and certainly the most innovative album of all time, the Beatles were about 24, 25 and 26. When they brought out the greatest piece of, you know, put together music in the world.
Yeah, it had to take its toll, and it did
yeah.
take its toll
yeah.
on all of them in different ways. But, you know, the legacy of the music is something we can enjoy forever. So not completely to be regretted, I suppose.
No, that's absolutely right. Did I read also that they're making a biopic on Amy Winehouse, which, you know, is going to expose some bigger problems than any of us have even known about?
There's this guy, Tyler somebody, can't remember his other name. He was her best friend from when they were about 13.
Right.
And he was living with her during times when he described this in one of the Sunday papers last weekend. He said, you know, that he'd be in the flat when people would turn up to take her out of bed, and she'd been suffering from a hangover for about 5 days, and pour her into a car to go on tour. So there was no real acknowledgement of her alcoholism, of her addictive problems. She wasn't getting the help that she needed.
Yeah.
And they were abusing her, weren't they?
God, that's awful, isn't it? Right, enough of that. Now then, Miss Jones, I've described you before as La Belle de Fleet Street. That's that's French for, you know, the best looker in Fleet Street.
Oh, well,
so
I had
speak,
some stiff competition, didn't I? There were some good-looking girls around in those days.
There were, actually, yeah. A mate of mine married one called Annie Leask. Do you remember Annie?
Annie Leask, Anna Pukas was another good-looking girl.
Anna Pukas was certainly around, you're absolutely
Annette
right.
Annette Witheridge, Pauline
McLeod. I saw Annette, actually, a few months ago. You've seen her at a lunch, haven't you? Was it Annette you saw recently? Or?
I've just been filming with her this week, funny enough.
Oh, right, okay. I saw her. She walked into the Bell in Fleet Street about 18 months ago.
That sounds like the opening line of a song, doesn't it?
Yes, she walked into the Bell in Fleet Street. I said, hey, babe. Get on the wild side. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, something like that.
She said, I'm already there.
That's right, yeah. But she did. She just, and I said, what are you doing here? And I'd finished working with somebody, and I just went into the Bell to have a drink. It's a completely fortuitous meeting. I think last time I saw her was about 3 years earlier in New York or something, you know. But anyway, here we go. But anyway, what I was going to say was, you will never have had a problem ever since your school days of being accused of being fat or a fatty or anything like that. So I'm reading this story that the Beano are now going to change the name of one of the characters, one of the cartoon characters, right, called Fatty, and they're going to call him Freddy. And do you know what? Normally, I sort of rebel at these woke-type things, you know, to change the world the way it is. But I do think, because I remember it happening at my school, it's horrible to be a fat kid at school. You get terrible, terrible abuse because school children can be so cruel.
Were you fat as a child?
No, I wasn't. I played football every day. I mean, I played for the school team twice a week, but trained every other day, and we played football during the lunch times, lunch hours and all that. So, no, I've never... Look, I put weight on, obviously, as I got into early middle age and all that, but no, I was very fit and agile and therefore very attractive to the opposite sex during my teenage and adolescent years. I didn't have a problem, but we had a kid in our class when I'm talking about 11, 12-year-olds now, and his name was Bob Jordan, and he was the school fatty. And it was awful the way, you know, he would get mocked, and he'd often be distressed, and, you know, he'd be in tears because of his shape and all that. And it was horrible. I really hated it. I've hated bullying ever since.
Yeah, I had a certain amount of it at school because I wore glasses from the age of 8, and I didn't have to wear National Health glasses because my mum used to buy me nice glasses, but they were still glasses. And I had a particular frame at one time, which was sort of dark, and they were very trendy, sort of black, squarish kind of frames. And all the kids used to call me Joe 90, right, which was a character on television, cartoon character.
Yeah.
And then they used to mess around with my name because obviously I'm Leslie Ann Jones. So in those days, you couldn't even say this now. They used to call me Lesbian Jones, which was pretty cruel because there was no reason for them to say it other than that it sounded funny to them.
Yeah.
So we always have to be a bit sensitive about people's feelings. In fact, we have to be a lot sensitive these days.
Especially with kids.
Especially with children, because the damage can be lasting. But I think that we can't be blanket anti-woke. But we do need to be sensible about it. Having different opinions from other people doesn't make anyone wrong. Tolerance is the watchword.
Definitely.
But we have to not go too far the other way and make it so that we can't make remarks about anything, which seems to be where we are at the moment.
Can you hear a noise behind me, Miss Jones, as we're recording here?
No.
A drumming noise.
Oh, there's a sort of scratching noise.
You know what that is? Where I'm recording from in my small studio at home, I've got a Velux window above me. Hail and hailstones the size of peas are bouncing off the window above me. But the sun is shining. That's the kind of crazy weather we're into at the moment.
Well, this is the aliens, you see. All the disrupted weather conditions, extreme weather conditions.
Yeah.
The volcano down in Stockbridge-upon-Avon, Surrey, is about to erupt.
Yeah.
Be careful.
No, you could well be right, believe me. Just getting back to the fat kids. I've had a guilty conscience ever since that I didn't stick up for Bob Jordan, you know, when he was getting mocked and abused. He couldn't run, for instance, so he never got picked for any of the football teams. And, you know, in the school sports day, they made him run. But he was always 20 yards behind the person before, you know, who came second last. And it was a horrible upbringing for him. His father was a doctor. That's the amazing thing. Dr. Jordan. And I've no idea why his parents couldn't have sorted it out for him. My mum and dad used to say there wasn't much medical science around in those days. Oh, it's probably a glandular thing. But I'm, you know, a kid's usually fat because he eats too much.
It could well have been a glandular thing, of course.
You
know, who knows? But if Bob Jordan's still alive and still around, we wish him well. And we hope he's having a very nice, healthy life.
As we grew into adolescence, so I talked about this happening at the age 11 or 12. By the time we got to 15, 16, 17, then we were in the lower sixth form and we became young adults and all that. His weight disappeared. Not entirely, but a lot of it did. We were both Everton fans. We used to go to Everton together, you know, and became a good mate. And then you forgot the previous years. I think kids want to forget all the horrible years before them, you know. But about 20 years later, it must have been, when I was a Daily Express reporter, I went to Crystal Palace and somebody had given me a ticket, you know, for a good seat in the stand. And I remember coming down the stairs at half time and a bloke was coming up the other way. And I thought, that's Bob Jordan. I'm sure it is. And that would have been, how old was I then? Must have been 25 years on. And he looked at me and I looked at him, but we didn't speak. We walked past each other. And I so regret that missed opportunity. And I wonder why I didn't speak to him.
Maybe in that split second, you were cast right back to the classroom and the playground.
Maybe.
And you felt a horrible guilt
Maybe.
At having not stood up for him and you just couldn't face him in that split second.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's honestly, I wouldn't rule that out at all. It could definitely be the case. Now then, Miss Jones, apart from the fact that I always pay tribute to your appearance and the way you carry yourself, how are your teeth at the moment?
Very fine indeed. Thank you very much.
Yeah. I'm looking at a newspaper headline from earlier this week, which I deliberately pulled aside to talk to you about this. The dentist will see you, in 3 years. Some NHS patients forced to wait until 2024 for an appointment. In a modern country like ours, fifth biggest economy in the world, going through a post-COVID economic boom, freed from the shackles of Europe, some would say, by Brexit, we're making people wait 3 years to have a filling. It's a disgrace.
Well, that is because we barely have NHS dentistry in this country anymore. I can't remember the last time I went to an NHS dentist. It always costs me quite a lot of money. I remember I had a crown done a couple of years ago. It cost me about 700 quid. A routine appointment is £95. That's when they don't even do anything. And the hygienist is another £95 when you go and see her separately. I think that this is a bit of a non-story, really, because NHS dentistry is a thing of the past. It's only really for people who can't afford to pay for their dentistry.
No, but Leslie Ann, I understand what you're saying. To me, it's a massive story because it illustrates we don't have any dentists on the National Health Service anymore. What on earth was the National Health Service set up for if it wasn't to provide basic health care at source? And one of the most important ones, which cause people the most pain and irritation, is dentistry. It's a scandal.
Well, yes, basic healthcare. You've just said it yourself. So, for example, when did you last get a pair of glasses on the NHS?
Well, never. I go to Specsavers now, literally.
Well exactly. Yeah. So these things are not provided by the NHS because our population exploded. There are too many of us. So the NHS cannot service the vast majority of the population for those things which are considered more cosmetic, I suppose.
Yes.
But, you know, things like you used to have, be able to have, you used to be able to go to your doctor, I should say, and have a skin tag removed or a mole or something like that. You'd see the nurse and they'd freeze it off. All of that is gone now. Those are considered cosmetic procedures.
Yes.
And you now have to go to a private dermatologist unless you can't afford it. Maybe if you're on benefits or something, and then they will refer you. But your referral could take a couple of years.
Yes, that's true. I mean, I suppose it's because we're a much wealthier society than we were when the NHS was set up in, was it 1948 or 47?
Yes, by Aneurin Bevan.
Aneurin Bevan, absolutely right, yeah. So, you know, I'm a big believer in the fact that if you can afford it, then you should pay for it. So I wanted to speed up the rollout of the vaccine by saying, look, we can speed this up by offering people to pay for it to get it done quicker. And people said, oh, you know, favouring the rich. I said, no, it just means you can speed up the rollout of it if people are prepared to pay for it, you know. But you're right with dentistry. In many ways, it's a scandal. I've had two implants done the last couple of years. Each cost £5,500. And that's my choice to have them done. I wanted the old tooth taken out and then they put a metal peg in and then they build the gum around it and then they put a false tooth on it. All that kind of stuff. I'm very happy with that. However, in the last couple of weeks, I've got pain in one of my teeth at the back of my mouth, not a false one, but a real one with a filling in it. And you know that moment when the blackberry pip, you know, gets onto your filling, you go, ooh, and I think I've got a cracked filling.
Oh,
so
no.
I'm going to have to get that done. Now, you're absolutely right. That will cost about 250 quid just to get the filling replaced.
Yeah. Yeah, but you can afford to pay for it, thank goodness.
Yes.
The NHS, you know, we have to remember that it's not there as a cure-all, a service-all. There are aspects of it, and it's in disarray. It doesn't have enough money. Well, actually, I think there is enough money in the NHS. A lot of it is administered.
Oh, yeah, it's
wasted. Because I knew a doctor who I was related to him by marriage. He's a professor now.
Right.
He resigned from the board of the hospital he was working for at the time because they bought a new computer system for the hospital. It was actually the Chelsea in Westminster, and it had sat rotting in the basement of the hospital because they didn't find anybody qualified enough to be able to implement the new system.
Yeah.
So they'd spent millions on this computer system for the hospital that basically became obsolete because they were still looking for the right technicians to put it into action. And he was so disgusted by that waste of money that he resigned from the board.
That's not the worst story in the NHS. I think they've spent something like 20 billion over the last 10 years setting up, you know, a new, you know, database system, the sort of thing you're talking about, which is still not fit for purpose. It's an outrageous the way they waste money in the NHS. The other thing I totally object to, why are there so many levels of control in the NHS? Regional health authorities, district health authorities, county health authorities. It's outrageous, honestly. What you need
that's because there's so many people, you know.
That's what I'm saying. And this was all built up during the Blair years, okay? I'm not being political now, But the whole idea of New Labour was to make sure everybody got a job. So they just kept building layer after layer after layer of administration in all government departments. John Prescott, if you remember, we even wanted to set up a series of regional parliaments on top of everything else we've got, you know. And it stuck.
Jobs for the boys,
absolutely. And it stuck ever since. But drives me mad. Ms. Jones, before we go, you've travelled around the world, and so have I. One of my favourite cities is San Francisco. I think my three favourite cities are Sydney, San Francisco, and Cape Town. Those are the cities I love outside of the United Kingdom, where I love most cities. San Francisco was one of the first great American cities I went to. I've been absolutely captivated about it ever since. The Bay Area, the Golden Gate Bridge, the fantastic views out across, you know, the San Francisco seafront and all that kind of stuff. I read a horrible piece last weekend that San Francisco is becoming a massive great slum, and that people, and I've heard about this from friends in America, are shifting out of California as fast as they can down to Florida and Texas. That's a matter of great regret for me.
I saw that piece and it is horrifying. I think obviously it's down to the lack of a welfare state in the United States.
Yeah.
There is no backup for most people, and people who lose their jobs, their homes, everything else, have to resort to living under canvas in these great cities, which are turning into slums.
I know.
It is a dreadful state of affairs.
It is shocking. And don't they say in the end, all great empires crumble? I mean, obviously, the Roman Empire crumbled. We know that. And Italy is a mere shadow of what it was when the Romans were around. And, you know,
well, the British Empire fell to bits, didn't it, in the end?
Say again?
British Empire fell to bits.
Yeah, it did. Yeah, it did. You're absolutely right. And that's because you run out of the ability to service them or cost them. I mean, the Second World War ended the British Empire, although it was on the way down before that. But it's a cost. But you're absolutely right. And you wonder whether, you know, the US, I, you know, look at the economies of everything, and I read everything I can all the time about it. China will never overtake America as the richest country in the world, because if you work it out on wealth per head, the distribution of wealth in America is not perfect, but it's a million times better than China, where some people are still so poor they work in paddy fields 16 hours a day. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, we have it easy compared.
Yeah, we certainly do. Right. OK, Miss Jones, thank you very much indeed. Always good to talk to you. Thanks to everybody out there. And remember, June the 21st, you can take our pubs, but you can't take our freedom.
I'm first in line for a drink, by the way.
Absolutely. She and I were ginger. My other sister, Adrienne.
You were a ginger. I didn't know you were a ginger.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've bright ginger hair. My hair was so...
You had dark hair when you were on Fleet
Street. No. When I was a kid, my hair was so ginger that I was called Ginger Nut at school. In fact, one rather cruel schoolmate said, "I'm going to call you Jaffa Cake." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Because you're ginger on top but soft underneath." Which I thought was rather cruel.
How did he know?
Yeah, well, no, he meant about my brain. You know what I mean?
Oh, I see. Right,
yeah,
right.
You know,
right.
Ginger on top, soft brain.
I thought we had a bit of scandal going on.
No, a scandal going on, for goodness sake. Normally, I sort of rebel at these woke-type things, you know, to change the world the way it is. But I do think, because I remember it happening at my school, it's horrible to be a fat kid at school. You get terrible, terrible abuse because school children can be so cruel.
Were you fat as a child?
No, I wasn't. I played football every day. I mean, I played for the school team twice a week, but trained every other day, and we played football during the lunch times, lunch hours and all that. So, no, I put weight on, obviously, as I got into early middle age and all that. But no, I was very fit and agile and therefore very attractive to the opposite sex.
The volcano down in Stockbridge, Surrey, is about to erupt.
Yeah,
be careful.
No, you could well be right, believe me.